around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Treasures from the Tanakh on Truth to You. That's truth2letteru.org. I'm Jono, and joining me is Torah teacher Ira Michelson. G'day, my friend.
G'day, how are you, Jono?
Doing very well, thank you, my friend. And today we are in Job chapter 28, and it kind of seems like a speech on the elusivity of wisdom. Is that a fair summary, if I could say that? The rarity that is wisdom?
What was the first word you used?
Elusivity. Elusiveness.
Oh, you know, because sometimes I use a word and you say, what?
Is elusivity...
What does that mean?
Is elusivity not a word?
Well, I guess it's probably a word. It probably just is pronounced a lot differently here than it is, you know...
I just made it up. Side.
Oh, you did? Oh,
it's it sounds like it should be a word.
It's like we say aluminum and you say aluminium.
That's because it is aluminium. What? Aluminum? That's like something from outer space. What?
So you go and buy aluminium foil while we buy aluminum foil. And it's much easier for pronunciation's sake.
We say tomato, you say tomato.
No, not necessarily. You do say
tomato? What are you talking about? We say tomato.
You do. Do you say potato too?
No, we don't. That's the ridiculous thing about it. We say potato. Do you say potato?
No, we say potato. But then I have a problem with the English language anyway, so.
It makes no sense.
Like, for instance, I don't understand why we call it a toothbrush when we brush our teeth with it. Why is it not a teethbrush?
Ooh, maybe, that's right, unless it's kind of small and you do one at a time. But it's not, is it? You can easily fit three teeth on the toothbrush.
Sure. And then we say, I'm going to get a haircut.
That's a blatant lie now that I think about it.
Sure.
We've inherited lies from our fathers. Ira?
I mean, what's up with going to get a haircut? We're not getting a haircut. We're getting all of them cut.
That's what my boys have just gone to do. And you know what? It's funny you should say that because I said to Honey, I said, so what are you doing? She goes, I'm going into town to get the boys' hairs cut. Plural. She said hairs. I thought, that's right. Well done.
Yes. It's like... We call it a staircase. Why is it not a stairs case? There's not just one stair on it.
That's fair enough, too. It's a crazy language.
It is.
It really, really is. It's inconsistent through and through. How much more difficult is it to understand the Bible in English when Hebrew makes so much more sense?
See, now you're making my point for me.
There you go.
Somebody said to me today in a discussion, they said, well, you know, what am I supposed to do? I read the text and I just have to trust what it says to me in my mind. And the guy that I was discussing it with is actually a NASA scientist. And I thought to myself, I said, so let me ask you a question. If a very well-known physicist writes an article and it challenges everything that you know about physics that you've learned with all your degrees and working for NASA, do you just look at it and say, well, I just have to accept what I'm reading based on what my mind tells me? Or do you try to check his formulation and look at his data and determine how he came to the conclusions that he came to?
Mm.
And he was like, well...
Which is a fair question.
It is a fair question. I just don't understand how people just... And this is the funny thing, that people just... There's something about the Bible that people just blindly look at things and say, oh, well, you know, how, if I can't trust the translators, who can I trust?
Mm.
And I'm like, what do you mean trust the translators? If anybody's listened to the show that you and I do long enough, they should understand that we certainly can't trust the translators on either side of the aisle.
No, it always pays as best you can, even if you don't speak, read, or even if you're not familiar with Hebrew at all, just get some starter tools and just familiarize yourself with just some basic stuff, because you'll be surprised what you uncover.
Sure.
Mm. In any case, chapter 29 of Job is where... No. Yes. No.
No,
28.
No, 28.
I almost jumped a whole chapter, Ira.
Yeah. You're in a hurry.
This is the way it begins. Surely, Ira, there's a mine for silver. I've been looking for it, but I can't find it. But surely there is one somewhere. I'd like to find it. And a place where gold is...
You get sure? Why are you calling me Shirley?
I've got Shirley. It says surely there is a mine for silver. Surely there is.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute.
So what is wrong already?
Of course it's
wrong already.
So remember, we talked about this, and I just want to refresh everybody's memory from last week that we finished up last week in chapter 27, and we talked about the idea that this And we're going to see a mashal here, you know, kind of like a parable, these two chapters together, 27 and 28. And then we see the same thing in 29 and 30 before we move on to seeing a new character introduced in the text. And what we did was we talked about the last two verses of 27 and made the distinction as to who it could be speaking of. Was it speaking about the storm, or was it actually speaking, was it God? When it says that he hurls or casts upon him without pity from his hand, he would surely flee, and he claps his hands at him and shall hiss or whistle upon him from his place. Mm-hmm. Why I'm bringing that up is because the very first word that we see in the Hebrew there is the Hebrew word ki. Ki. And it doesn't mean surely. Ki means, it can mean for, it can mean that. And so in this case, what it's showing us is that this is a continuation, that it's not just a separate chapter. It's showing us that we're continuing in this chapter with his premise, with this mashal that he's talking about. So it would be really for there is a source or a mine for silver and a place where gold is refined, is how it really should be read.
So if it was, for example, a therefore, as they say, you have to see what it is therefore.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so therefore, there is a mine for silver and a place where gold is refined. Iron is taken from the earth and copper is smelted from ore. Now, does that give us a clue as to the dating of the book of Job? Have you considered that?
I haven't, honestly. No.
I didn't either. But you know what? I'll just read this a little note that they've got here in the New King James, the Nelson's New King James Study Bible. It says right there, it says, the mention of iron being mined from the earth implies a time after the beginning of the Iron Age, around 1200 BC, for the writing of the book of Job. So there's, you know, there's something to consider.
Never really thought about it in that way.
No, it didn't occur to me, but there's something for the listeners to ponder upon. It goes on to say, man puts an end to darkness and searches every recess for ore in the darkness and the shadows of death. He looks for ore in the shadows of death. He breaks open a shaft away from people in places forgotten by feet. They get this, they hang far away from men. They swing to and fro. I in my imagination, in my mind's eye, I imagine the a mine that just goes, that digs straight down, and that these guys are sort of perhaps with a pickaxe or something like that into the wall, into the sides of this mine, swinging on a rope to get around. Is that perhaps what we're reading here?
It's possible, but there's some other verses that I think will give us some understanding about that. I just want to take a step back for a minute.
Sure.
Because, of course, we know that eventually we're going to get to the whole crux of the chapter, which is about wisdom. And if we look at this as a continuation, like I said, from chapter 27, in chapter 27, verse 6, Job says, in my righteousness I am strengthened and I will not fail. My heart will not reproach me from my days or as long as I live. And I think what we have to keep in mind here is that that the debate has been going on back and forth this whole time between him and his friends regarding the righteous and the wicked.
Mm-hmm.
And Job has been maintaining that his friends have kind of been giving him these useless explanations as to the fate of the righteous and the wicked. And so we just have to keep that in mind. And we have to keep in mind how significant the concept of wisdom is, because it appears 18 times in Job and 4 times alone in our chapter, the Hebrew word chokhmah. And I just want to bring a couple of examples of that before we move on. And,
sure.
So far, uses it in chapter 11. Starting in verse 2, he says, to Job is a multitude of words unanswerable, and should a man full of talk be accounted right, or should a man of lips, is what it says in the Hebrew. Your prattle may silence men. You may mock without being rebuked and say, my doctrine is pure and I have been innocent in your eyes. But would that God might speak and open his lips against you. He would tell you the secrets of wisdom, that there are two sides to prudence. Know therefore that God has overlooked some of your iniquity. In other words, he's saying, you're not even getting what you really deserve, Job. God's overlooked some of your iniquity, but not all of it. And then Job answers him back in chapter 12. starting in verse 2, Job says, "Indeed, you are the people, and wisdom will die with you."
But that's sarcasm, right? That's sarcasm.
Yeah, of course it's sarcasm. He's like saying, he's going, of course.
You know everything. You're the one with all the wisdom.
Please do tell.
Come to me, and I shall bestow upon thee my knowledge. Amen.
Amen. And then he says, "But I have understanding as well as you. Mm-hmm. I am not inferior to you. Who does not know such things?" And here's my favorite. My favorite is Job chapter 13, verse 5, where Job is still speaking, and he says, "If you would only keep quiet, it would be considered wisdom on your part." Now, how many times have you wanted to say that to somebody? You know, real wisdom would be if you just shut your mouth.
If you just shut up. Oh, what? Now there is a saying, isn't there, that said? Now I can't remember who said it, and I'm just gonna. I'll have to paraphrase, but better to be a silent fool than to speak and remove all doubts.
Ah, there you go.
I'll just attribute that to me. No. Someone wise said that. I can't remember who's responsible for that one.
What is the word again? That's elusivity.
Elusivity.
Elusivity. Mm. So, as we move forward, we need to see the distinction being made by Job between what man thinks about wisdom or what godly wisdom really is. And I think that's the whole point. And so when we get into these next couple of verses where it talks about, you know, darkness and to all the limits he searches the stone of deepest darkness or the shadows of death, because that can be a reference to death, like you said. Mm-hmm. What I see here is in these references to mining, that while man may seek to mine things in the earth, there's a place in the deepest darkness that not even man can attain. Mm-hmm. That in other words, there's a certain amount of knowledge that we can attain in this world, in this life, but the source of wisdom remains hidden. Mm-hmm. When you get into that idea of the trench that you're talking about or the tunnel, it's very interesting, and the reason why it's interesting is because it says paratz nachal, and paratz, like peretz, is the idea of this breaking through. And nachal can actually mean a stream or a river as well. You'll see that when you go to Israel in a few weeks. Places you go to, you know, that are called the river, it'll say nachal and whatever the name is. So it could be a couple of things. It could be referring to things that come to an end, meaning that, you know, they've forgotten they are forgotten from the trodden path. Mm-hmm. It could refer to some of the things that we talked about early on, where we talked about these dry riverbeds or these wadis that people would go to for, you know, in relation to wisdom or knowledge, you know, and come and expect water, and yet they were dry. Mm-hmm. But what I think is really interesting, like you said, in that idea of hanging and this kind of shaking and going to and fro, if we think about this idea of paratz nachal, the breaking through of water, or so let's use your example. Let's say they're mining. Let's say they're using a pickaxe or whatever. Imagine if they hit water. Mm-hmm. And the water broke through and started taking the earth out from under their feet.
Mm.
And so that's
but it's not under their feet. They're hanging. They're dangling. They're swinging.
But wait, before we see the hanging, what does it say? What does the verse say just before we see that they're hanging and shaking? Okay. What does it say?
So it says he breaks open a shaft away from people in places forgotten by feet.
Forgotten by feet.
Mm.
They hang. So if there's a breakthrough of the, you know, it's just a possible translation because it's very difficult in the Hebrew to kind of exactly know what's being said there, but I think it's very possible that's one possible interpretation, that it could be that this breaking through of the water, you know, causes the earth to come out from underneath their feet and causes them to kind of just be hanging there,
mm-hmm.
you know, in this deep tunnel or deep shaft.
It certainly paints a picture of a rather precarious situation, that's for sure.
Oh, regardless. Yeah, I mean, even if it would, you know, regardless whether it's my interpretation or your interpretation, both of them is, you know, absolutely puts whoever it is in a precarious position if they're hanging in a trench or a tunnel, because nachal could be translated as a trench or a tunnel as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it reminds me just, I mean, you're right. I do believe you're right when you say it's painting a picture of the how difficult it is to mine out wisdom as opposed to the way that we take treasures from the earth. That and this is what Treasures from the Tanakh is about, Ira. It's about mining for the knowledge and wisdom, is it not?
There you go.
How about that?
Treasures from the Tanakh.
It all comes together. And but it does remind me of the comment that Job made in 27:12, where he says to his friends, "Why then do you behave with complete nonsense?" And they claim to have wisdom. They do. And it's funny because my son said to me the other day, it was an interesting question. He said, what's the cheapest thing in the world, Dad? And I said, mate, it's probably opinion. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, everybody's got an opinion. And it's another saying that I've heard on a number of times, that opinions are the cheapest things in the world. Everybody's got one. And Job, I think, here is making the difference, illustrating the difference, saying that what you guys have got is nonsense. What you guys have got is just opinion. Just because you think you sound wise in your own eyes doesn't make it so. In fact, wisdom is a very, very, very rare thing. Yeah, and this is the case he's making.
I think you're hitting it spot on. Absolutely. Good-o.
So five, is that where we are? As for the earth, okay. As for the earth, from it comes bread, but underneath it is turned up as by fire. What does that mean? It's turned up as by fire?
So think about it. If we look at the earth, and of course you grow some things there, I would imagine. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I've got my vegetable garden is looking pretty good at the moment.
Right, but if you go down far enough now, so just under the surface of the earth, you can grow wheat, you can grow whatever you need for bread, and lechem doesn't always mean bread, it can mean food as well in Hebrew. So certainly we bring forth food from the earth, and we grow things from it, but it's not that far down in the depths below that you're going to hit things like salt and sulfur and things like that. And if you go to the bowels of the earth, then you're talking about molten lava, you're talking about fire that comes up. So basically, what's happening is he's setting up here for what's coming in the next verse, which is that if you're willing to go past that which produces bread or that which produces food, and you go to the less hospitable parts of the earth, you can reach what's available. What's that in the next verse?
Its stones are the source of sapphires, and it contains gold dust.
Yeah.
That's all right.
Yeah, it's, you know. And
I've always wanted to do that, by the way. Wanted have to get you really? And, well, we live on the Lachlan River here in New South Wales, and I always figured I should get a pan and just go and do a little bit of panning for gold.
So it's interesting. We have a television, you know, America is really big on reality shows.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how that is in Australia, but, you know, very big on reality shows. And one of the reality shows that we have is called Gold Rush. And it's, you know, it's about these different crews that go out there and have claims in Alaska, you know, up in the Yukon that are mining for gold, using heavy equipment and things like that. And they have to go down. And it's funny because sometimes what they do is just that. They have a guy that comes in and takes core samples and goes down sometimes 30, 40, 50 feet into the dirt to take a core sample to see what comes up in the dirt. And then they determine whether or not the gold is too deep for them to have to mine it.
Mm, interesting. So, but that's where it is. And so it's stones. It's verse 7, that path no bird knows, nor has the falcon eye seen it. The falcon's eye has not seen it. I've got the proud lions have not trodden it, nor has the fierce lion passed over it. But I've got a little asterisk there, Ira.
Of course you do.
In verse 8, and I go down and it says, literally, sons of pride. So sons of pride have not trodden it, or sons of what does it say in the Hebrew?
So it says, let me just get there real quick. V'nei shachatz, and v'nei shachatz literally means sons of the proud or sons of the arrogant. But many of the translations will translate it as mighty beasts, as it relates to the lion as well. So it'll say
it does.
Like
in
the
my
mighty beasts have not tread and the lion has not passed.
So the NJPS does that. The proud beasts have not reached it. The lion has not crossed it. Verse 9, he puts his hand on the flint. He overturns the mountains at the roots. He cuts out channels in the rocks. And his eye sees every precious thing. He dams up the streams from trickling. What is hidden, he brings forth to light.
You're like in a big hurry today.
Am I? What? Just what? What did I just do? Three in a row?
No, it's okay. But
you got something there?
Yeah, I'm going back though.
Go on.
So you when you read verse 7, you read something about the path of the bird does not know, and the falcon's eye does not gaze on it. But it doesn't say the path of the bird. It says the path of the bird of prey.
Oh, really?
Does not know, and the falcon's eye does not see it. And what I just wanted to say about that is that things like that are significant, because the bird of prey there is talking about a vulture. And if you know anything about vultures, you know anything about falcons or eagles, you know, that are typically birds of prey, they have
a keen
very
eye.
Keen sense of sight.
Mm.
Very keen
oh,
sense
look,
of sight.
Oh, look, you know, we watch them here out in the field, the kites and the eagles and the falcons, they circle around the fields, and every now and then, if you're lucky, you'll see one drop down, claws first. Claws? They got claws? Is that what they are?
Talons.
Talons, that's what it is. Talons first, and then they'll take off with a field mouse or a rat or even a baby rabbit.
Right, and they can see.
But the heights that they circle at, you think, how can you see anything in the grass? But they do.
Exactly, and it's actually, there's an interesting verse in the Talmud about that. In the Talmud, in Tractate Chulin 63b, it says that the vulture could be standing in Babylon but still be able to spy out its carrion in the land of Israel.
Uh-huh.
And so what it's doing is it's describing these paths as so desolate that not even the birds of prey with sharp sight can detect anything there.
Fair enough.
With flint, he sends out his hand, he overturns the mountains by the roots. And so in spite of this, and who is the, he overturns, you know, who is the he there? Well, of course, we're talking about God. So in spite of the most desolate of places, these tunnels, these trenches, the shadows of death, the deep, dark places, the places where lions and mighty beasts and the sons of the arrogant don't tread, and that the eagle and the falcon and the kite and all of these birds of prey with keen senses cannot see, that in spite of these most desolate of places, even here, God does as he wishes and even overturns the mountains. He calls forth streams from the rock.
You have some opposition, Ira. You have some opposition. You do. There's some disagreement in the ranks.
From who?
Well, from both the New King James and the New JPS.
Well, there's a big surprise.
I've got.
That's why I said, you know, sometimes you don't trust the bias of the translators on either side.
Here's a really good example. So it's because I did wonder about this when I read it. And verse 9, I've got in the New King James, he puts his hand on the flint, he overturns the mountains at the roots, he cuts out channels in the rocks. Now, this is all capital H so far, but at the same time, it's the beginning of a sentence as well. So we can't be conclusive as to where they lie. But when we get to verse 10, it says he cuts out channels in the rocks, and his, lowercase h, his eye sees every precious thing. And so really what they're suggesting is this is the endeavors of man that achieve this. And then in verse in the NJPS, they insert a word, I think, perhaps, I don't know, maybe you can confirm this for me, in the Hebrew, verse 9, they begin not with he, but with man. Man sets his lowercase h, hand against the flinty rock, and he carves out the channels and so on and so forth. So they disagree. They think it's talking about men.
Yeah, I know what they think.
Well, I know you know. I'm just pointing it out.
But
it doesn't.
So
verse
think
nine,
about
verse
this.
Nine doesn't
right.
begin. Verse 9 doesn't begin with man, does it?
In the JPS, it does.
Well, yeah, in the JPS, but in the Hebrew, it begins with his, right? Lo, what do you got?
Oh, so in verse 9, I'm just trying to look at. I was looking at something else. Bachalamish shalach yado.
Did you say ish?
No, I said no. Bachalamish shalach yado. So in flint, he sends his hand.
He,
yeah,
not man.
Of course, it's not man.
What do they write man there for?
But look at the context. How could you attribute some of the things that we're talking about here?
I don't know. I mean, when you look,
when we look at verse 10, in rocks he cuts out channels, and all precious things he sees with his eyes.
Knows. But I mean, what? You know, we've seen some incredible engineering feats in the ancient world,
right? Really, he binds the weeping of the streams, and the hidden things are brought to light. Verse 11. Mm-hmm. That's man. Man binds up the streams.
Well, it's possible.
What are they talking about? He builds dams? Is that what we're talking about? Really?
Why not? I don't know.
Really? So you think that they had dams back in the day of Job, huh?
Don't know.
No. So I'm going to tell you what I think.
Go on. That's why you're here.
This is me. You know, I'm giving you my opinion now, okay?
Yep, go for it.
We see this calling forth of streams from the rock and even bridging, mm-hmm. and we've seen streams come from the rock before, and even bringing the rocks to an end. To me, when we see this idea of he cuts in rocks, he cuts out the channel and all precious things he sees with his eyes, we're talking about the fact that there's nothing hidden from God. He knows the beginning from the end. He knows the source because mm-hmm. he is the source. If he mm-hmm. destroys the rocks, then he brings forth the waters in its place. Amen. In verse 11, he binds the weeping of the streams and the hidden things are brought to light. To me, I actually believe that this is an allusion to creation.
Ooh, okay.
Because it's at that time that he brought from the depths of the waters, he fashioned the dry land.
He did.
In other words, he bound up the waters in order to let the dry land come forth.
True.
And there's another possibility that we did not address, and I addressed this at the beginning, this word key, okay? Mm-hmm. And I want to address it now because we're getting into verse 12, which I think is a separate unit. We have two yes. separate units here, okay?
I agree.
And so this word key can not only be just merely a continuation from the last or from the beginning of the Mashal that we saw in chapter 27, mm-hmm. but it can be seen in contrast to the Vav that starts off verse 12 and sets it up as a separate unit. At the end of the first unit, I think what we're meant to learn is that everything has a beginning and an end.
Mm-hmm.
However, as we move forward, we learn that it's only wisdom that has no source other than from God and is without it.
Mm-hmm.
That you can have all these precious things in the world, but wisdom, as you said, is not something that you can get through. And I think we'll talk about this further as well, that there is no physical source for wisdom.
Mm. Yes, and that is a very clear point. But where can wisdom be found, Ira? And where is the place of understanding? Man does not know its value, nor is it found in the land of the living, as you were just pointing out. The deep says, it's not in me. The sea says, it's not with me. It cannot be purchased for gold, nor can silver be weighed for its price. Shall I continue?
Well, look, I mean, even this, we can compare this to some of these reality shows, too. There's another reality show like Gold Rush called Bering Sea Gold, where these guys go out to the Bering Sea. And when it talks about the deep says it's not in me and the sea says it's not with me, you know, there are great things of great price in the sea as well, like pearls. They go down and they mine pearls and they mine gold and things like that. It's talking about all these different physical phenomena and it's comparing or contrasting that there is no value that you can place, that you can measure these things of great worth against the cost or the price of wisdom.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It cannot be valued in the gold of Ophir, in precious onyx or sapphire. Neither gold nor crystal can equal it, nor can it be exchanged for jewelry of fine gold. No mention shall be made of coral or quartz, for the price of wisdom is above rubies. Do we have any carbuncle in there? I know that's one of Nehemiah's favorite words.
Carbuncle?
Yeah, carbuncle. I can't remember which one it is, but one of those one of the stones that's mentioned in the breastplate of the high priest. It's a long story.
It must be.
It's a cool word, though. There's another word.
Speaking of pearls, we must be talking about pearls from the Torah. Did he talk about that in one of your...
He spoke about carbuncle. It must have been the passage with the breastplate.
Actually, you know what I like about verse 18? What did you say something about the something with ruby?
No mention, Ira, shall be made of coral or quartz, for the price of wisdom is above rubies.
Price of wisdom. Actually, that word is let me see. Where is it there? Umeshek.
Ooh, like a pouch. Pouch. In...
Pouch. That's what I'm getting. Well, I know what I got. It's a pouch. That's why I'm bringing it up.
A pouch of wisdom.
What do you mean?
Better.
If you had a pouch, why did you say the cost of rubies?
But the price. The price in the New King James has got the price of wisdom.
But then, where are you getting pouch from?
I got pouch in the new JPS. It says a pouch of wisdom is better than rupees. Verse 19, the topaz of Ethiopia, the topaz of Ethiopia cannot equal it, nor can it be valued in pure gold. A lot of emphasis on gold. So then there's the, here's the question, Ira. The question is, verse 20, from where then does wisdom come? Where does it come from? And where is the place of understanding?
Right. So didn't we hear about this already? So think about this. Even, you know, remember I spoke about this earlier, about seeing this chapter as two units. And it seems that in the second half of the chapter, we have two sections to the second unit. So in other words, we got the first 12. 12? We had verse 1 to 12. And then from 12 on, we was supposed to be another unit. But within, from verse 13 on to the end of the chapter, it seems like the second unit actually has two sections. And so we look at when we look at the verses up to this point, what did we read? What did we read in verse 12? It says,
so it begins by saying, where can it be found?
Right.
Where can it be found, and where is the place of understanding? Now, this verse is saying, well, we've established that it can't be found. Well, so then where does it come from?
Right, but we're seeing almost the same wording.
Almost, yeah.
Almost the same wording. And what we see is, not only do we see two sections in this unit, but they're almost exactly the same number of verses. So we have seven verses in this first section, and then seven verses to the last section, and then we get to the answer in the last verse, in verse 28.
And it does, I'm glad you brought that up, because it does read like a psalm. I mean, it really is a psalm.
It very much is. Very
it
much.
Very much is to wisdom, and or like a proverb, like a set of proverbs. It reads like, which is interesting, but it says from where...
Well, wait a minute. So think about that for a minute. What is proverbs called in Hebrew? Mishle.
Mishle, thank
Mishle.
You.
And so what did I say this is? I said it's a mashal. And so mashal is the singular of mishle.
There you go.
So
we agree. We concur.
It's like a psalm. It's poetry. Remember, we're looking at a poem here.
It certainly is. It certainly is. It is hidden from the eyes of all living and concealed from the birds of the air. Have you just got birds of the air?
The birds? No, I don't. But you want to know what I have?
Well, I'm just wondering if it was birds of prey again.
No, it's not. It's birds of the heavens, actually. Shamayim, Hashamayim is what it says.
Ah, of the heavens.
Ume of Hashamayim.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but I guess that's really the birds of the air. I mean, that's the same thing. But now, Ira, we're doing a bit of this again, but it gets a little bit more complicated because I've got, you know, capital D destruction and capital D death. I've also got in the new JPS, it's got Abaddon and death, both capitalized. But not only are they capitalized, they say something. These personalities are given words in their mouth, and they say, inverted commas in the English at least, we have heard a report about it with our ears. They've got ears. What's going on here?
You know, I actually put it in capital letters just for you here in my notes.
Very good.
I didn't put an asterisk. I should have put an asterisk there so we could...
Well, I don't have an asterisk or anything like that.
It's kind of a silly question. I mean, not silly from you. I'm just saying, overall, it's a silly question because we know that this would be like having the discussion about whether or not God has ears and God has feet and God has a right hand and so forth. You know, the fact that we personify, first of all, remember, we're talking about a poem here. We're talking about Mashal. So to talk about the personification of death and to try and put capitals to it to attribute it to a certain type of entity or a certain individual entity is ridiculous.
So this is just a figurative illustration.
Absolutely, it's when we talk about these things, remember, we always have to be careful that we're not hyper-literalizing things that are meant to be metaphorical or agotic. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, you know, we shouldn't take those things and take something that's literal and try to make it allegory or metaphor or agotic either. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the errors that most people make. And I think it's so interesting that this happens. I think it's so interesting that it happens from New Testament believers, because they should be the ones that shouldn't be the ones that do this, because you know, they follow, you know, they follow Jesus, who spoke in parables. Mm-hmm. And so they should understand the language, you know, parabolic language. And yet it seems like they just do the opposite when it comes to the Tanakh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So I do agree. It's a figurative illustration here in verse 22. It goes on to say in verse 23, God understands its ways. He knows its place. For he looks to the ends of the earth and sees under the whole heavens to establish a weight for the wind, to establish a weight for the wind and apportion the waters by measure. Hey, that's pretty cool. Just the thought of that, to establish a weight for the wind. The force of the wind is measured and established by God. That's really cool.
Right. And so here is where it gets really interesting for me. Because, of course, this is all speaking about the omnipotence of God. And when we read something like, who sets the weight of the wind and the waters measure he sets, and then it says in verse 26, what? When he set the statute for the rain and a way, actually, literally, it says in a way for the storm clouds thunders, or actually it could mean in a way for the thunderbolt's voice.
Cool.
Which is very interesting because that word kol or kolot here, or the last word in the verse here, means voices. But it could also mean thunder. Mm-hmm. That was really cool when I was a little kid growing up. I always, knowing that in Hebrew, knowing that, like, for instance, Judaism, we call the voice from heaven the bat kol. But it also means thunder. And so I would be walking outside and I'd hear thunder. And I always thought that was the voice of God thundering from heaven. But I want you to read something for me.
Mm-hmm.
I want you to read something for me because I think this is so cool when we talk about the subject of wisdom, and that's Proverbs chapter 8, speaking about Mishal,
yes.
The book of Mishlei. Proverbs chapter 8, if you could read for me chapter 8, verse 22 to 30.
22 to 30 says, Yehovah possessed me at the beginning of his way, before his work of old, I have been established from everlasting, from the beginning, before there was ever an earth. When there were no depths, I was brought forth. When there were no fountains abounding with water. Before the mountains were settled, before the hills, I was brought forth. While as yet he had not made the earth or the fields or the primal dust of the earth, when he prepared the heavens, I was there. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep, when he established the clouds above, when he strengthened the fountains of the deep, when he assigned to the sea its limits so that the waters could not transgress his command, when he marked out the fountains of the earth, then I was beside him as a master craftsman. I've got with an asterisk. Would you like me to investigate that further?
Actually, no, that's not a bad translation.
Wow, okay.
It's the Hebrew amon, which could mean master craftsman or actually architect. It'd be a good translation of that as well.
Very good. And I was daily his delight, rejoicing always before him, rejoicing in his inhabited world, and my delight was with the sons of men.
Right. Beautiful, beautiful poetry as well. And isn't that amazing how it speaks of, and that's speaking of Chochmah, Mishlei chapter 8. The whole chapter is about wisdom.
Mm.
And it talks in the same language we're seeing here in Job about the, when it talks about inscribing a circle on the deep. Remember, we talked about that in previous chapters, that circle, almost like chok, statute, like he sets a statute for the deep, this idea of limiting the waters and so forth. This is what we're reading about in these verses in Job chapter 28. And what's amazing about that is, if you ask in Judaism what that's referring to, it's referring to the Torah.
Oh, really? Indeed.
Because it's taught in Judaism, one of the first things that we learn, and this even goes back to the very first word in the Torah, you know, which we can connect later when we get to the end of this chapter, that it's taught from, you're taught from a very young age that it's by and through the Torah that the world was created, that the Torah was the blueprint for creation. And is it interesting that Chochmah, the wisdom of God, is spoken as an Amon, as an architect? So we have that idea of the blueprint and the architect being there, pre-existing, the Torah pre-existing with God, and being the blueprint for creation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that reminds me of another verse. I'm just going to go there now. If I remember correctly, Psalm 119, verses 98 or 99? Oh, how I love your Torah. 97. It is my meditation all day. You, through your commandment, make me wiser than my enemies, for they are ever with me. I have more understanding than all my teachers, for your testimonies are my meditation. I understand more than the ancients, because I have kept your precepts. So on and so forth.
Amen.
Loves Psalm 119. Where are we up to?
So 27, and this is where we're going to confirm. This is where we're going to confirm in verse 27 what I just said and what you just said from Psalm 119.
Then he saw it, what I've got is that he saw wisdom with an asterisk, and it says literally it, but I think within the context that's probably fair. Then he saw wisdom and declared it. He prepared it. Indeed, he searched it out, and to man he said, "Behold, the fear of Yehovah, that is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding."
Right. So what do we see in verse 27? Why do I say verse 27 will support what I just said and what you just said about the Torah? And we talked about it. He what does he do? It says he saw it. What did your say? Declared it, or
then he saw wisdom and declared it.
He established it and also searched it out.
Sure.
Right?
Yep.
The third word there, when we read this in the Hebrew, it says, az ra'a v'sapra. And v'sapra is where we get that samech pe resh there, is where we get like the word sefer, which can be book. And it doesn't necessarily just have to mean declare. It's also the word where we get the word sofer for a scribe. And it can also mean in the Hebrew to make a written record.
Uh-huh.
And that's the beauty of this verse in light of what we read in Proverbs chapter 8, because we were given the written record of wisdom, and it's called the Torah.
Mm.
And he established it there in Proverbs chapter 8. And he said to man, "Behold, the fear of the Lord is wisdom, and to turn aside from evil is understanding." And I said that we would see this in the very first verse. This is why the very first word in the Torah, Bereshit, is said to be such a difficult word to translate, because Reshit always, when we see a word like that, it typically always has a noun connected to it, and we don't see that. Anytime, if you were to do a word search on the Hebrew word Reshit, you would find that there's always a noun attached to it, and typically one of the ones that we see is what? Chokhmah, wisdom. Reshit Chokhmah. What is it? The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, like we see here in Job. And so here we have Job kind of ending this first mashal that we've been talking about in the same way that King Solomon did in Kohelet, in the book of Ecclesiastes. What does he say? He says, the sum of the matter when all has been considered is what? Fear God and keep his commandments, for that is all of man's duty.
I've got in the New King James, this Ecclesiastes 12:13. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter, Ira.
Mm-hmm.
Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all.
Right. And so here we are. We come to the end of this first mishnah. And I think Job presents why he has taken this belligerent stance against his friends. He's basically saying if he's unable to understand God's ways, he can accept that. But he's not going to trade the wisdom of God for the nonsensical arguments of his friends that attribute unrighteousness to him. And I think what he's doing is he's maintaining that the only way at this point, with everything that he's gone through, and with, not going into details, but we remember what Job has gone through. We remember what his physical condition is like. And he maintains here that he can only demonstrate his loyalty to God by his relentless challenging. Challenging God for what he's going through.
Fair enough. And it reminds me, too, just before we jump off that, Psalm 111, verse 10, that the fear of Yehovah is the beginning of wisdom. A good understanding have all those who do his commandments. His praise endures forever.
And if you look at that in Hebrew, it'll say Reshit Chokhmah.
There it is. Beautiful. Ira Michelson, Torah teacher, my friend, thank you for coming back onto Treasures from the Tanakh on Truth to You. And by the way, a reminder to everybody, Treasures from the Tanakh, there is a Facebook page. There's also, of course, the Torah Threads. Torah Threads Facebook page and the website Torah Threads. And how's that coming along, my friend?
Torah Threads is coming along good, and it's really interesting because a good friend of mine that I'm working with that helped me with Torah Threads is actually in the land right now as we speak. Ooh. And he's meeting with some of the rabbis that we've been talking to, rabbis that have now come to the conclusion that there is a necessity for teaching Torah to the nations, and that people are taught in the proper way, that they're not taught the way they've been taught by people who don't know and don't understand Hebrew and don't understand what the Torah is saying. And I'm very excited about that because, you know, hopefully by the time he gets back in the next few weeks, we will be spending more time on the website, adding a lot more information to it. We'll be adding a virtual classroom that people will be able to come in, and there'll be a schedule of different classes that will be available for people to come in and participate in on many different subjects related to the Tanakh, related to the Torah, and it's really going to be fun.
Grand. So that's TorahThreads.com, right? TorahThreads.com yes. is the website. Again, thank you, Ira Michelson, Torah teacher. You've been listening to Truth to You. We're going to be in chapter 29 next week. And until then, dear listeners, be blessed, be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.